Now listen.
Listen to it.
Hey, you are now listening to Golasso with Carlos and Paul.
Hey, my name is Ferris Owens, and you are now listening to Golasso.
This is Coach Paul. You are now listening to Golasso with Carlos and Paul.
Hey, this is Coach Carlos, and you are now listening to Golasso with Carlos and Paul.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Golasso with Carlos and Paul. Thank you for listening to us and joining us today. We appreciate you guys for supporting us throughout each episode, and we have a special guest on the show today. Our latest guest to Golasso with Carlos and Paul is Coach Jocelyn Carter, a professor of psychology and the director of clinical training at DePaul University in Chicago. Coach Jocelyn, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
And, you know, just want to say beforehand, we appreciate your time. We appreciate your effort and the energy that you're going to give us throughout the whole episode. So thank you again.
You're welcome.
And even though you're officially a professor, we also like to call our guest coaches. Just and I know you're coaching on your daughter's team. So to get our conversation started, could you talk about your background and your work as professor of psychology and director of clinical training at DePaul?
Yeah, I would be happy to do that. I am a clinical psychologist by training. I did my graduate work at Vanderbilt. And have been at DePaul since 2008. It's easy for me to mark that because I was pregnant with my older daughter when I started. In my work at DePaul, I really focus on child development and optimizing child health outcomes. So a lot of people think about that just as physical health, but I think about that in terms of mental health as well. And one of the things I've been doing throughout my career is really focusing in on things that will help kids with both their physical and mental health. So I use a stress and coping framework for a lot of my work. So we know that kids, unfortunately, are they experience lots of different stressors. That's actually one of the things that brought me into wanting to be a psychologist rather than a lawyer. I thought I would work in the juvenile justice system, but when I did a summer internship in Louisville, Kentucky with a group of kids at a residential psychiatric treatment facility and spent time learning lots more about the children and their home lives and the things that had happened to them and how they responded, I really wanted to do work where I could help help them cope with all of these things that happened and help other people understand that even though as adults we think that kids have life easy, they actually don't. And there's a lot that's not under their control. And as adults, we have a responsibility to help make the environment better and safer for them. We know from lots of research that I've done, that other people have done, that kids are pretty resilient. But that doesn't mean that there's not pain and there's not real like negative impact that can happen to them and put their development on a slightly different track than it should be. So my work as a professor and doing my research at DePaul has all focused sort of on that sort of general goal of improving mental and physical health. And I really approach it too, from a perspective of supportive relationships. So within the community, within peers, so friendships and mentors maybe that are similar in age, and then family members. So that's what I do, sort of the professor hat. And then in terms of my role as director of clinical training, I'm overseeing a PhD program in clinical psychology that make sure that our graduate students who are going to be future clinicians and researchers and do all kinds of great things, advocates, they're starting nonprofits, they're amazing, but I try to make life as easy for them as possible, as easy as it can be to go through a doctoral program that's hard and challenging, And so I really like that role as well. So that's what I do at DePaul.
Great. So what intrigued me in terms of the idea of having you on our podcast was a recent column that you wrote for U.S. News and World Report, in which you detailed how the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted sports. And you obviously went into detail on that disruption, but you also noted in the column that the pandemic offers an opportunity to make esports more equitable. And equity is obviously a key focus of our podcast. So in that context, could you elaborate on how the pandemic can help provide new pathways for under-resourced environments and in terms of having greater access to sports?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, it's always hard to talk about the pandemic with this sort of positive spin because it has been really, really hard. So I don't want anything that I'm saying to make it seem as if it's just like rose-colored glasses with viewing it. But I do think that one of the things that has been a blessing of the pandemic is that it really has transformed a lot of the ways that people view the world and view things like their time, what matters most to them when you're facing something that's unprecedented and you don't have a playbook for how to handle it. We have to do lots of readjustment and realignment and thinking about what matters most to us. And the COVID-19 pandemic is obviously what lots of us think about first. For me and for many others, we are also thinking about racial justice and how that layered into the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think we had, as a country, a lot of discussions that were long overdue about how, first of all, how the COVID-19 pandemic revealed a lot of health inequities, just in sort of in terms of the physical health, but then also knowing that that things were experienced very differently for the people who are most marginalized and oppressed in our country. So I think that those things together really help set the stage for, okay, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? When we're building back and thinking about coming out, we're still, I feel like, slowly transitioning out of the pandemic. We don't have to go back to doing things the same way that we did. I know I'm, you know, very excited to return to normal in some sense, but when normal wasn't working for everyone, then I think we have to think about what we're going to do differently. So I think the COVID-19 pandemic and the sort of isolation of lockdown and the increase in sedentary behavior, I think that gave people an opportunity to see, like, okay, actually moving my body is good for me. Seeing other people is good for me. So we had a virtual school, we had virtual happy hours, we did all kinds of things virtual. And those were okay. It was better than not doing those things, but it wasn't a substitute for real life interactions, preferably outdoors, although I'm in Chicago and our weather is really unreliable. So being outdoors is not always pleasant, but we know it is good for us. So we also know from the pandemic that mental health has suffered, and it's largely because of this loss of connection, but also all these other stressors and strains that have been going on for a really long time. So what I think about in terms of sports, and especially coming out of the pandemic, is that they really are a way to improve mental and physical health for kids who one would not be excited about going to therapy in the first place. In a lot of the communities that I've done my research, you know, therapy is not something that people are necessarily very excited about. It's expensive. It's hard to access. We do have a therapist shortage. But the benefit of sports is that you can reach a large group of people together and have some of those great mental and physical health benefits too. I also know that there are new sources of funding available as sort of relief or from the government in terms of focusing in on sort of COVID-19 recovery things. So I think that sports can be a really great component of that. And private foundations are interested in this too. And then in the news cycle over the past couple of years, we keep hearing more about athletes and how they're paying attention to their mental health and making decisions for their own careers to not just prioritize their sports performance, but also prioritize their mental health. And I think some recent cases of, for example, college athletes, for example, killing themselves has really put the sports mental health connection in the forefront of people's minds. So I think since we know how important mental health is, we know how important sports are, it's a really great time to think about sports programming for kids coming out of the pandemic.
Sorry about that. I was on mute. Thank you, Coach Johnson, for that wonderful explanation. And so it kind of ties into smoothly into my next question. But before I get into my next question, I do agree that I think I can sympathize to what all coaches or mentors were going through, especially during the height of the pandemic, where I also was doing nutrition and soccer sessions virtually. I was also doing just straight soccer sessions virtually. And although it wasn't the same, I do agree that it was like a safe space for our children. And then, you know, there's also the question of who has access to what. And so that's a whole different topic, but I can sympathize in that. And I understand like what we had to do. Like we had to pivot, you know, like we couldn't be outside. We couldn't be exposed to one another. But I think that's the creativity that has come out with from the pandemic. So I appreciate your answer. And so my next question to you, Coach, is you also state that the U.S. can equip nonprofit and community-based sports organizations with tools to improve equity and inclusion practices. Do you mind just expanding on this point and what specific tools these organizations will need?
Yeah, I would be happy to do that. And I sympathize from the coach's perspective too about these virtual sessions as a parent. For example, my 8-year-old hated her virtual foot skills sessions, and I had to stand off camera like basically telling her to keep going with them. So I can't imagine how frustrating that was for coaches. But yeah, we tried our best for sure, parents, coaches, and kids. But in terms of the specific tools that organizations can use, I think about them in a couple buckets. The first is, I guess the phrase that gets used most is like equity audits. So I'm a data person, I'm a numbers person, and I'm always really interested in terms of just getting, even though it's not the whole story, getting a snapshot of who is involved in your organization. So what does the racial and ethnic background of your players, so the kids look like, coaches, and then larger organizational leadership, like executive director, and thinking about if there's a match between what an organization says their goals are and then what they're actually doing. So I've asked some, this is mostly in my personal life, when I've asked people these questions of like, where's the representation in your coaches? And people say things like, oh, well, anyone can apply to be a coach. We're not restricting. But that's not a good enough answer to me anymore, especially if your organization, for example, is serving mostly Black and brown kids, and all of your coaches, for example, are white. Organizations, I think, have a responsibility to work harder to make sure that their coaches and their staff reflect the kids that they're working with. And that's not to say that, you know, white coaches can't coach black or brown kids, but in a sense of the organization, thinking about what kinds of messages that sends to the kids, and then really how committed are the leaders to making sure that this happens. So it takes extra work. That's okay. I think it's worth it. So that's sort of one kind of thing. So it's more about the coaches. Thinking also about the kids and the players as you develop through sort of the different levels of competition, and so for example, like recreational versus elite, if you have a system where there's maybe a lot of representation in the rec level, but not in the more competitive or elite or travel, you have to think, well, what's the pipeline here? Is there some bias in terms of the way that we're providing attention or opportunities to try out, kinds of things like that? So I like to make sure that the numbers, at least on like a quick read, actually match up and reflect the community and the values of the organization. And then thinking really about what some of those barriers may be and what the organization can do to be a little bit more proactive. So maybe it's arranging, transportation, or at least setting up some sort of like norm that it doesn't have to be each player's parent taking them to and from practice every time, but people, trade off, or coaches. I know it's hard to schedule like playing field time, but thinking about, okay, well, this time is really inconvenient for parents who work a certain kind of job to be able to get their kid there. So what else can we do to make life easier there? So that's like the removing barriers bucket. And then the thing that's probably dearest to my heart is making sure that that coaches, and I know there's a lot of volunteer coaches who maybe don't have a lot of time to commit to training, and so thankful for volunteer coaches out there. But I think coaches don't always appreciate, because they've got so many other things going on, planning drills, all of that, what the social climate is like for players once they get to practice or once they get to games. So I think that a lot of times adults, this is all adults, not just coaches, are unprepared for instances of, for example, like a comment that's like a stereotype about an athlete from a particular background. Oh, of course they're fast. They're whatever, or this is like natural talent, but this person is like really skilled. So stereotypes, microaggressions, or just plain old like really overt racial kinds of comments can be made by kids towards their teammates. And I think we as adults in general aren't necessarily prepared for those kinds of things to happen. So I think knowing in advance, like sort of setting the expectation, these kinds of things will happen, and that's okay. And it doesn't mean that, the people should get kicked off the team or, reprimanded or whatever it is, but just know what you're going to do to respond. So what you're going to say in the moment, and have sort of a plan for that, and not just be taken off guard, because a lot of times when we're taken off guard, we sort of just like don't say anything. And then the message that sends to the child who's had that comment made is like, this person doesn't notice, this person doesn't care, they're not able to be a source of support for me. So that's, I think, a really important kind of training. It doesn't have to be a huge amount of time, but just know like these kinds of things will come up. If they haven't to you this season, like they definitely will next season, they're coming one way or another. Then I guess the other part of that bucket is just that there are some kids who are more challenging to work with in a team environment, or really any kind of environment. And I think that having this sort of shift in perspective about what's going on with that kid can be helpful. So that they're not intentionally trying to cause trouble or wreck your practice or, you know, pick on other kids, but knowing what we know about trauma reactions and kids' ability to regulate their own emotions, I think that kind of knowledge can be really helpful in terms of supporting that child. And I know they're probably, you know, one of many, or maybe you're on a team where there's, you know, it's half of the kids on your team. But I think those kids are the ones who we most need to keep playing sports and the ones who will benefit the most from consistency, stability, maybe like high expectations with high levels of support. So maybe it takes even giving them like a little bit of a leadership position or a chance to excel and like serve as a role model, even if they're not the kid that you would naturally go to as the role model or the example, because they're not as compliant with you up until that point in time. But those kids, they're a little bit harder to sort of bring into the fold. But they're the ones who, if, you know, they, I don't know if coaches really do this on teams, but, you know, if you say like you get in trouble this many times and, you know, you're off the team or you can't practice or you're punished by like sitting out, those kinds of consequences are not going to be the most effective for kids who have, for example, in their family or home or school lives, lots of inconsistency and lots of instability. So I would encourage coaches just to have more patience, to still have high expectations and let the kids know what you want, but give them lots of opportunity for success and be okay with like them, just being a little bit more challenging and sort of reminding yourself that they're doing the best that they can under the circumstances and they're not trying to make your life hard. But life is just hard for them. So those are the three buckets of things that I think about in terms of tools for equity and inclusion.
Well, thank you so much, Jocelyn, for giving us those examples. And I think I can definitely agree with you on the last part. I work with children as my full time, and then I come back to coach in my neighborhood. And so all those years of coaching and working in schools has definitely built up my patience, and definitely it was hard as soon as we came back from virtual practices into an in-person setting. So yeah, I've kind of grown and learned along these years what's the best course of action when you come up with complex situations like behavior and stuff like that. So we appreciate your answer to that question. And so my next question to you, Jocelyn, is we also noted that in your column, you wrote that in the pre-pandemic research, it shows that the children of color who can access high quality of sports programming through community and school partnerships are less likely to experience issues like depression and anxiety after less than a year. Do you mind providing additional details on your research findings about this?
Sure. So that study was based on a really cool project that I did. It seems like just yesterday, but it was a little it was longer ago than I. It was almost 10 years ago. I got funding from the Consortium to Lower Obesity in Chicago Children. That's a group in Chicago. To work with a community-based agency called Urban Initiatives, and they have expanded a ton since those early days. But what we were trying to do in that project was really compare children who had gotten the Urban Initiatives intervention in one school year to kids who had not. And the city of Chicago, if your listeners aren't familiar with it, is fairly racially and ethnically diverse, but also very segregated. So one of the things that we were thinking about in the design of the study was making sure that we were comparing children from schools that were very similar. So we had two schools that had predominantly Black students, so like 99%, and then two schools that were 99% Hispanic Latine. And we gave one of each of those schools the intervention in 1 year, and then the other school did not get the programming that year, but we expanded it so that they had the programming the following year because we were really excited about the program. And it's not fair to say, if you agree to be in our study, maybe you'll get the program, maybe you won't, and you just sort of have to be okay. That's not the way schools like to do research. So everyone eventually got the Urban Initiatives programming. But in that first year where we were comparing pre and post intervention, and I'll back up and say a little bit more about the intervention. So it was really cool. At each school, Urban Initiatives found a school liaison who was a school employee who agreed, and they got paid to do this, to serve as the point of contact and work with the coach from Urban Initiatives as well. So each school decided whether they wanted their practices to be before school or after school based on the school start time and end time and what else was going on. So some of the schools had all their practices before, some of the schools after, but three times a week. Then there was a game every week, and the kids could only participate in the games if they had made their academic progress goals during the week. So there was like a weekly report card. In addition to learning how to play soccer, they also got some nutrition training, character development. So a lot on how to be a good teammate, how to be a leader, things like that. But for each practice, they had at least, practices were an hour and a half, at least 60 minutes of soccer, and then about 30 minutes. And I know the coaches talk about, like, at first the kids did not like the healthy snacks, but were like apples and oranges. They're, where are my Cheetos? And they're like, no, we're fueling you to be a good player. And eventually the kids came around, I think, mostly on that. And what we saw, so in addition to at the end of the year, compared to kids who were not in the program, kids who had been in the program had reductions in depression and anxiety symptoms. We also measured what we call externalizing symptoms. So that would be more of like the acting out and aggression. We didn't see effects for that over the course of the year. But we actually, and how I had mentioned the study design a little bit at the beginning of my answer, we actually saw the reductions in internalizing symptoms primarily for students who attended the primarily Black schools. So we didn't see as big of a shift in that in our Hispanic and Latine populations. But one of the reasons for that is because those groups had a little bit lower symptoms in the first place. So maybe there wasn't as much room for the intervention to improve that. Also, the big thing that we saw that was published in a separate paper from that same intervention project was changes in body mass index over the year as well. So we saw that kids had lower body mass index or did not increase in their body mass index to the same extent in the intervention schools as compared to the control school. So really excited about those findings. And and it's always great when you can do research that helps your community partners then make their case to grant and other agencies about why it's worth continuing to invest in that programming. So that was a really, really fun project.
Well, Jocelyn, we're getting near the tail end of this conversation, and I just want to thank you again in advance before we wrap up for participating in this conversation. It's been great. It's nice to get we typically talk to a lot of coaches, so this is, I think, at a whole nother level in terms of your insights. So thanks again for taking the time today. So just a kind of a wrap-up question. I know this might be a little tougher than the other ones, but if you have the power to change one thing in the world of youth sports that would help foster a more equitable environment, what would that be and why?
Yes, that is a very challenging question, and I love it so much. I was thinking about a couple different options, but I think I've settled on like one that maybe combines two. So I think that making all sports programming, or most sports programming, free for all kids. And I'm going to say, and this is a little bit back to what I said in the op-ed, is having it be at school, because we know kids are already going to school, ideally, and it removes a barrier. So if it can be before school or after school, free, and something that's, I don't want to say mandatory, because you don't want to force kids, but normal, like the social norm is that all kids are doing some sport, and they don't have to be, they don't all have to be great at it. You don't have to even be good. Like that the point is to show up, to do the sport and have fun with it and get your body moving and meet people. So I would love all kids to have that kind of experience where all ability levels are welcomed. And obviously for kids who have more talent and have more interest, they can do more things. But I think, yes, having it really be part of the norm, and one of the ways that it can be part of the norm and part of the social culture is if there is no barrier. So let's have it be free, let's have it be at school, and let's have it be fun for everyone.
Yeah, and I guess that gets to and one of the things Coach Carlos and I have addressed throughout our podcast is something as simple as infrastructure. You know, I mean, I think it's safe to say in a lot of suburbs in America, they've got, you know, more of an ability to build out in terms of just literally physical space in terms of fields and whatnot. But I think that's one of the great things about soccer is you can always kind of create an environment. Maybe it's not an AstroTurf field or even a grass field. You can always think of creative ways to give kids that opportunity to play no matter where they're at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my even though my daughter's school has a ton of fields, they don't have the field space for the 7th and 8th grade girls, and so we set up our cones on the lawn and dodge like puddles and goose poop and whatever. They can still play.
Yeah, I completely agree. No. And then my last thing I'll add, Coach, and then we'll transition, is that. Yeah, I completely agree with your statement, and I think that more organizations and more like new things have to happen within schools, and I think that is a great barrier. I think one of the greatest barriers in community-based sports and doing stuff in urban areas is that transportation. So I completely agree with what you're saying. I think there should be more programs included in school, whether it be before care, after care, or even during class periods. So I completely agree with that statement. And so as we transition into our wrapping up, as Coach Paul said, Justin, just wanted to ask if you have, you know, for our followers, obviously we'll put all our episode, we'll go through all these Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Buzzsprout, but I don't know if you have any social media or anything that we can add to our page, or if you want to just, you know, if you have a Twitter, shout out your Twitter account. We would love for people to read more about your work and stuff like that, and we can also post it on our social media page. So if you have any spaces that people can follow you, we'd be happy to shout you out.
Sure. Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Dr. J. Smith Carter.
There you go. So Golasso followers, go follow follow Jocelyn, Dr. Jocelyn. And again, we'll put her Twitter page or your at on our social media pages as well. And then we'll also put the articles too, so that people can read about the articles that Coach Paul and I, we're reading as well. And with that, we just want to say thank you again to Dr. Jocelyn. Thank you, Coach Paul, for finding this gem. We appreciate you. And if you want to listen to this episode and other episodes beforehand, you can follow us on Facebook at Golazo, GOLAZO, with Carlos and Paul. You can find us on Twitter at Golazo Podcast 20. And you can also find us, as I said, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Buzzsprout, iHeartRadio, all these great platforms to listen to this great episode. So we want to thank you on behalf of Coach Paul and I, Dr. Jocelyn. Thank you so much again for hopping on our show today. We appreciate your insights. We appreciate your energy. And we hope to speak with you soon.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
In this next conversation, I got the privilege to interview one of New Jersey's finest, Coach Jessica Gonzalez. Ms. Gonzalez is a 1999 graduate from the College of New Jersey. She has a Bachelor's of Science in Corporate Fitness. And Jessica has been a professional educator for Hamilton Township Board of Education in Health and Physical Education, K through 12, for the past 16 years. Coach Jessica is the owner and director for JG Soccer Strength and Conditioning. And Jessica's soccer credentials include Nottingham High School Hall of Fame, First Team All-American, Trenton State College, Rookie of the Year, Trenton State College, which is now the College of New Jersey, NCAA Finalist, New Jersey Semi-Professional Wildcats Player, First Team All-American, Hamilton North High School, Female Athlete of the Year from Trenton Times, New Jersey Olympic Development Player, the New Brunswick Assistant Girls Varsity Coach, Hamilton Northhead Freshman Soccer Coach, and Assistant Varsity Boys Soccer Coach. Here, in the next minutes or so, you'll hear some questions that I asked Coach Jessica Gonzalez in regards to her life and her soccer life.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Golazo with Carlos and Paul. I'm actually here at the 2022 Urban Soccer Symposium today, and I'm with a special guest. We've been wanting to have her for a while. But, you know, pandemic and life does happen. But I'm happy to introduce you guys to a great coach, a great female coach, hailing from New Jersey. Let's give a warm welcome to Coach Jessica Gonzalez. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Hello, everyone. How are you doing? I'm happy to be down here in Washington, D.C. to represent New Jersey for sure.
My first question to Coach Gonzalez was, who is Coach Jessica Gonzalez and what is she about?
I am a school teacher in Hamilton, New Jersey. I teach at Wilson Elementary. I am a director and owner of Jessica Gonzalez Soccer Strength and Conditioning. That's been my business for 19 years. I'm a mother of two beautiful children. One's 14, Marcello, and one is 9, Matteo. I'm also a loving daughter and sister, and I'm a wonderful girlfriend, and I'm an amazing coach.
My next question to Coach Jessica Gonzalez was, how did she get into soccer?
How I got into soccer was I was running in gym class, and my teacher said, you are so fast, you have to play soccer. And I said, sure, I'll try it. And so she wound up becoming my high school coach, and she's a dear friend of mine, but I started when I was 11 years old, and everybody else started when they were 4 and 5 years old, but I just started, and I was on a rec team, and then as soon as I was on a rec team, this one guy saw me and said, I want you to play for my travel team, and I started playing travel, and the following year, I was already on the Olympic development team because I had such skill, and they all saw it, and they pulled it right out of me.
My next question to Coach Jessica was, as a Latina woman, how was her experience like playing D1 soccer in New Jersey?
I was always, I don't know, I was always the only Spanish girl on every soccer team. I was always the one Spanish girl, pretty much. I don't remember another Spanish girl on my team ever when I played this, all my years of playing. It was just always me, I don't know. So I had something to prove. I had something to prove that I could do it. I was just as good as anyone else, and there's nothing stopping me, nothing, no color, nothing. And, you know, we had a few different nationalities on our team too, and it was only one. There was like one African-American, one Chinese girl, one Spanish girl. Like, we were always a minority. Like, it was just something I knew, you know? And it didn't matter to me. Like, I mean, I still have the same blood that they have. It's blood, right? It's not, who cares about your color? So I went to the College of New Jersey. I played there. And then my sophomore year, I guess, my sophomore year, I got into a car accident. And this car accident, it stopped my life, and I woke up out of a coma 2 months later. Mm-hmm. And this car accident, the doctors they said, you'll never be the same. You know, you have head injury, you have head trauma. You're never going to be able to play soccer again. You can never head the ball again. Because if you do, you can die. And I said, all right, you know, I understood what he meant, but what was I going to do? Like, I couldn't head the ball anymore, and I was a sophomore. Mm-hmm. I was in the hospital, and they said all my teammates and all my schoolmates, classmates, everyone came to the hospital to see me, and they were like, I didn't even remember I played soccer. Like, I had no idea. I'm like, what do I play? And they said, you made first-team All-American, Jessica. I'm like, what's that? And they were like, first-team All-American, Jessica. I'm like, yeah, what is it? And they're like, it's the best 11 girls in the country for college, right? And I'm like, wow. And once I got back to being myself, and with a lot of help from a neurologist and a cognitive therapist and a psychologist, just to give me help and like who I was again. Mm-hmm. I realized I had to pick my head up and live and like relearn all this stuff again. I had a broken jaw. I had 3 reconstructive surgeries on my mouth. I had lacerations on my face. And I was 20 years old, and I had to get braces again because I had 11 root canals because my mouth is so, like, wired and jacked up that I just wouldn't look up. I wouldn't look up. I was it made me a depressed person after that because I didn't want to, like, look up at anyone. I thought I saw so many ugly things in my face, and my it just really saddened me, and it made me a little depressed. It made me just depressed, and I don't know, somewhere inside I was like, I have to be a fighter. I have to like fight over this depression and get back to what I was.
Yeah.
So the psychologist brought in my mom and dad and my best friend to see like, what's Jessica like, and my brother, like, what's she like? And they're like, you know, she always smiles, like she doesn't smile anymore. And I had braces. I had braces on my teeth when I was 21 years old, my top, because my teeth were like, you know, really messed up. And they said that I was prom queen and I was homecoming queen, and I was always smiling and I was always helping people. And they just said, she's such a great soccer player. Like, she's infectious. Like, all she wants to do is help the next person. And she's such a good friend. And all these things, they were like, look up. Like, you know, the psychologist, like, you have to look up. Like, do you hear what they're saying? And I was like, wow, like that's the way I was. And then like, thank God, my personality, it just clicked back in of who I was. And I'm like, I love soccer, you know, and I can't believe, like, what am I doing? So I still played soccer my junior and senior year, but it was different. I became a sub, and I didn't even know what a sub looked like. I'm like, what the hell am I doing sitting on the sideline? Like, I don't even know why, but he's like, my coaches were amazing. They were like, you know, you got to sit on the sideline because we don't want you to get hurt, you know, but they would put me in. I would get in there, I would score, and then it would take me out. I'm like, well, why did I have to come out? You know, I just didn't understand that, but they, like my entire team just like put a safety blanket on me, and they're just like, go out there, get it, and then come back. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So I did everything they asked me to do. I never quit soccer. I finished to my senior year, and I gotta tell you, it was the most, it was life-changing, this accident. Like,
my next question to Coach Gonzalez was, she mentioned briefly about her camps and her conditioning program. So what is JG Strength and Conditioning Program?
So my program is, it's a soccer camp for kids ages 4 to 17. And when I started my camp, I just knew like I was good at what I do, and that's soccer. And I know that I have a lot of skill to share with kids. And I know that if I could help them become better versions of themselves, I want to try and do that. So I started a camp 19 years ago, and it was a little camp, Jessica Gonzalez Soccer, and a lot of people came, and I was like, wow, like I can't believe all these people who came. So, you know, obviously I have my LLC in it, and every year it just got bigger and bigger. And then my two sons, like my one son was born, and he would go to camp, and then he would help me at camp. And then my other son was born, and they were always helping. They're always there. They could tell you how to run the entire camp if you asked them, you know? Mm-hmm. And I could not believe how many people kept coming back. So it was like my following just kept getting bigger and bigger. So then I studied exercise science in college, and I do personal training. So it's not just about soccer. It's about fitness, like your fitness level, so strength and conditioning. So I had to make my camp like Jessica Gonzalez Soccer, strength and conditioning. So it's like it ties it all together. Mm-hmm. My kids also play a lot of sports. They play baseball, basketball, football, you name it. And so all their friends were coming to camp for the strength and conditioning part, because I teach health and phys ed, and everything's fun and fitness for me. And so it became even bigger. So now I have like 8 camps during the summer, and then I also do indoor soccer at West Windsor Athletic Center. And then I have a winter camp, and then I do a spring camp on spring break, and then I do my whole summer camp for all the weeks of summer. Mm-hmm. So it's like I never stop doing soccer. Mm-hmm. And on my off time, I train travel teams, and I train personal training, like just one-on-ones. But it's like I never stop. It's just soccer. It's always soccer and strength and conditioning. So
my last question to Coach Gonzalez was, where can we find her information?
So thank you, Jess. Thank you, Jess, for sitting down with me and for giving us your time, your energy again for Golazo with Carlos and Paul. Where can people find more information about your summer camps and more information about you?
Well, thank you so much for having me, first of all, Carlos. That's awesome. I am so proud of you and what you do, and I think that it's great that you're getting a lot of information out to the world, and just I love that you're doing this podcast. I'm very proud of you. And you can find me at JG Soccer. strengthandconditioning.com. That's my website. And if you go on that website, you'll find all the information you need about camps, about everything that's coming up for the near future. And that's it. But I really appreciate you having me here. And God bless you. And I hope everything goes well for your podcast. And anyone out there listening, please, please help the children around you, because they need you. They need a voice. And please be that voice for them. So thank you, guys.
So those were our conversations with Dr. Jocelyn and with Coach Jessica Gonzalez. We enjoyed it, so we hope that you guys enjoyed as well. Again, you can find us on Twitter at GolazoPodcast20. And you can find us on Facebook at Golazo with Carlos and Paul. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Buzzsprout, and other platforms, wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to have you around soon. Thank you.